Well, greetings everyone and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide over the internet. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on Can They Do That? Right after this. You know, the income tax and Social Security programs are not compatible with our traditional American values, and that's because these two programs are the second and the eighth planks of the Communist Manifesto. These programs call for a heavy progressive income tax in place of tithing. Social Security is a social welfare scheme that takes the place of strict liability and individual responsibility. The income tax requires of us that we serve two masters in violation of Matthew 6, verse 24. This income tax requires of us that we rob God in violation of Malachi 3, verse 8. The income tax requires of us that we commit idolatry in violation of Exodus 20, verse 3. The income tax requires of us that we use unjust weights and balances in violation of Leviticus 19, verses 35 and 36. And the income tax requires of us that we sign contracts with foreign and alien gods in violation of Exodus 23, verses 32 and 33. And Social Security violates the strict liability statute in Exodus 21, verses 28 through 36. And Social Security violates the 10th commandment by appealing to our lust and greed. And then we're taught to call that income redistribution, but the scripture calls it covetousness in violation of Exodus 20, verse 17. Now, how do you like that? Now, the God of Israel gave us a better way of life than that, and you know our founding fathers at the Constitutional Convention back in 1787 actually outlined, followed, and put into our Constitution a better way of life than that. And that's why I contend that you and I ought to learn how to practice that better way of life. And if you'd like more information about this thing of tax and status, why don't you call us here at the law school? The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. While you're at it, be sure to ask for our free general law CD package. It's a four-hour commentary on the law school, and remember, it's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative, best of all, doesn't cost you anything, it's free of charge. Now, our school, Tax and Status, is on compact disc for adult home education. And if you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email and send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Once more, that's georgegordon.org. Or call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we've been talking about can they do that? And the answer is, in most cases, yeah, they can do it because they're already doing it. But are you going to let them get away with it? That's the other side of the coin. What if you were a big multinational corporation like Texas Instruments and you wanted to make a policy change that involved the paychecks of all 70,000 employees? Let's suppose that you're writing checks to your employees every Friday. So you've got to write 70,000 checks. Let's just plug that in. 70,000 checks times 52 weeks a year. That's 3,640,000 pieces of paper every year. And let's suppose for the sake of our discussion that those cost you times 0.10, or a total of $364,000 a year to write those checks. And all of a sudden, the bank comes to you and says, listen, we have an electronic model here, and you can save that $364,000 a year that you're spending writing those checks for all these employees. Now, let me tell you, 10 cents a check would be a bargain. It probably costs them more like $1 or $2 a check. Remember that you've got accountants and you've got machinery and equipment that has to turn out those 3 million checks. And all of that breaks and all of those people have to be paid. And so when you get down on the bottom line, the job of issuing the paychecks to all of these people is going to cost you $1 a check or more. You know, accountants don't come cheap. Machinery and equipment and office supplies and stuff, that doesn't come cheap. Just the cost of having the checks written up costs you money. So you want to save, you know, you're the CEO of Texas Instruments, and you want to save the company $3 million, $6 million, $10 million a year on writing all these checks. So we have to convince our employees to make this change. Now, it takes some salesmanship here. You know, people have been used to getting their paychecks. And I can remember when I was a kid, before they had paychecks, people got paid in cash. And before they were getting paid in pay envelopes and cash, they were getting paid in coin. In fact, the post office back in 1877, I believe it was instructed by Congress to pay their employees in coin, not checks, not warrants, not paper money. They had to be paid in coin by law. Now, paying in coin is a lot more difficult than paying in paper. Paying by check is easier than paying by cash. And now, if we could get off these checks and just have direct deposit, just an electronic transfer, that once the calculations for deductions and everything are made, we push a button and it's all done electronically. Hey, makes all the sense in the world for Texas Instruments to do that. And they did that some years back. One of my students was working for them. He didn't want to join the direct deposit program because he didn't have a bank account. So if he was going to join that program, he would have to go open a bank account. He didn't want to do that. Now, Texas Instruments, now from their point of view, they know that if they go out here and just tell everybody, here's what we're going to do, now that's going to meet with a lot of resistance and a lot of hard feelings. And so the logical thing to do is you go hire a consulting company and you ask them, well, how do we accomplish this? What is the psychological modality that we need to use? And so the first thing you do is you go out and you sell it. So you write up a brochure and you give it to all of your employees describing all of the wonderful benefits that you're going to get, the convenience, the safety. You know, when we were paying people in cash, the safety of getting a check. See? Well, now, instead of giving you a check, we're going to talk about the safety of having a direct deposit. So you have this direct deposit put into your checking account, done electronically, and it's going to be swift, fast, convenient, safe, all these benefits. And we're starting the program, and it's totally voluntary and blah, 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 and over about, several months, about 25% of the employees at the company opted for the direct deposit, which is about normal. You know, 25% of people will buy anything. But 75%, the vast majority, said, no, we think we'll just stay right where we're at. We're happy, and we're not upset with this at all. So Jimmy Wallace once said, don't bother me none. So this process goes on for a while. Now, this is what we call the camel's nose in the tent. We got the camel's nose in the tent. Now we have a dual system. We got paychecks for 75%, and we got direct deposit for 25%. Now remember, our goal now is to move all of our employees to direct deposit. Can we get 100% compliance? You bet we can. You bet we can. And Texas Instruments did it. They did it. Now, as we progress along, we're asking the question here, well, can they do that? Well, they couldn't compel everybody to do it, but they could induce everybody to do it. And so they started off with a campaign. They got 25% compliance. Now we come to phase two. In phase two, we come back with another brochure and another campaign some months later, and we say, our direct deposit program is such a success that more than half of our employees have opted for the direct payment program. Now, that's a lie. It isn't half the people. It's only 25%. But we want to tell everybody that the majority of people in the company want the program, desire the program. Just ask your coworker how it works. Well, you can go out here and ask 10 people, and you're going to find two or three of them, at least, out of 10, two, that have opted for the direct deposit. Now, are you paying attention? Did you ask 10 and find five, the majority? No. No, you ask a few guys, or you're talking here at the lunch counter, yeah, I got direct deposit. Yeah, it works pretty good. Yeah, I like it. Well, of course the guy that has it likes it. Remember, he volunteered for it. So now we have the people who have the program actually selling the program for us because they would be in the position of saying, I opted for it and I don't like it. See, nobody who opts for it voluntarily is going to come back and say, I made a mistake. Stick with your checks. Because in reality, all you're going to do is go down and deposit your check, mail in your check in some way, physically. And it saves that hassle, doesn't it? All right, so now as we progress along, we find that the second program induces many more people to join up. Okay, and so now we're moving closer to this magic 50%. We haven't got it yet, but we're getting closer. After doing two or three of these programs, we will achieve the 50% goal that we're looking for. Once we hit the 50% goal, now we legitimately have half, don't we? We have even come out and offered our employees free toasters and free this and free that and benefits, just like banks do. If you'll open an account here, we'll give you free checking until we get you sucked in, and then pretty soon we take away your free checking. We give you this super good interest rate until we get you sucked in, and then we take your interest rate away from you after we get you in debt here soon. So Texas Instruments, now they got 50%. Took them some time, about a year or so, and they got half their people. Now they come back and they say, now it is so popular, and the vast majority, see, it isn't the vast majority, it's just half. But now they come back and they tell everybody, the vast majority see the wonderful benefits that come from the direct deposit program. And because of that, we are going to adopt that as our company policy early next year, which is about 6 months away. And we are going to require everybody to sign up for direct deposit. Now remember, you have to sign up for this. I mean, you've got to physically go into the office and sign a contract with the company. So now it's company policy. It's kind of like Social Security, isn't it? Everybody, when you ask them, or when you tell them, I don't have a Social Security number, they say, it's the law. See, now the rest of the people, they're going to say, oh, it's company policy and we have to do it. Well, what are they going to do to you if you don't? So now, because it's company policy and they keep telling you about the deadline, here's the deadline, here's the deadline, it kind of works like this television ad. You know, if you've got analog TV, you've got to get a converter box. And they keep telling you, we're going to shift this over, we're going to shift this over, here's the deadline, here's the deadline. Okay. Well, they're just doing the same thing. Just doing exactly the modality. We need to move everybody in America from analog to digital, and we're going to do that. And it's probably good for us. I mean, you know, our masters have probably decided that digital TV is better. It certainly must be better for the advertisers and the television companies and the people that want it. I never did move for it. I didn't write my congressman and say, my God, I've just got to have digital TV. Now pass a law. I'm just having this forced upon me. It's just evolving upon me, whether I like it or not. So the question arises, well, can they do that? Well, in the case of television, you know, if you want to watch your TV, it's going to come in digital. And they just build it right into all the new TVs over the last 5 or 10 years, you know. So it just happens that our TV here is digital anyway. It doesn't really make any difference. I'm not out one way or the other. If it's an improvement, fine. If it isn't, that's another story. It's probably got some detrimental aspect to it that I don't know about. But in any event, now about another 25% of the company's employees move over because they now think that it's the law. They now believe that it's the thing we have to do because it's company policy. Well, my God, now they do have the vast majority. It is 75%. And in about 2 years' time, they actually moved 75% of their employees from checks to direct deposit, which is a big savings. But remember, our goal is to get all of our employees. We don't want a single employee left out of direct deposit. So now we come to the last phase. So in the last phase, we say, now everybody is signed up with the exception of a few. There's only a few people that have refused. And so now we villainize the people who have refused. Everybody has complied. Everybody's taking advantage of all of this wondrous direct deposit benefit program. But there are a few out there, a few holdouts, a few antisocial nutcases, right-wing, probably terrorist types that are holding up the parade for everybody else. Now, actually, these holdouts aren't causing any problem for anybody except the bookkeeping department of Texas Instruments. They're not causing any problems to the machinists and to the factory workers and forklift drivers now, are they? How does my getting paid by check and you getting paid by direct deposit affect your job driving forklift over here now, Bob? Come on. So now the company says, well, if you don't sign up for direct deposit, now they set another deadline. If you don't sign up for this direct deposit by this date, then we're going to terminate you. See, what we're going to do now is we're going to create peer pressure. And then we're going to use threat and fear. See, you're motivated by five motivators. It's vanity, jealousy, lust, greed, and fear. So we're going to use the fear factor. We're going to fire you. This moved everybody that was left out of the direct deposit. Well, all but five. That was it. And this guy, Mark Veazey, was one of them. Now, Mark was one of my students, and he had decided that he wanted to quit anyway and go into his own computer business, but I pointed out to him, I said, you know, this would be a good legal test if you wanted to test a discriminatory policy in employment. And can they do this? Because you have to have a bank account. Can the company compel you to open a bank account? Just like, can Tennessee compel you to join Social Security in order to get this benefit? Now, I've got a right to work here. I've been working here for a long time. Now, can you fire me because I don't want to participate in the banking system? Well, that's a legal test. And that's the kind of thing. Can you make me ride the back of the bus because of my skin color? You know, if we could make you ride the back of the bus because of your skin color, couldn't we make you ride the back of the bus based upon your eye color, hair color, or mode of dress? You know, if you're not dressed in a tuxedo, you can't ride in the front or the first five seats of the bus. Now, I mean, we can come up with all kinds of rules. I went through that with Ronnie Mitchell when we were playing sandbox when I was 5 years old. But is that really the way that we want to conduct business? Did we want to compel these people to convert over? Did we want to force these people to join the banking system just because we do? I mean, I don't deny that banking is convenient and that you have a bank account and you probably ought to have one. But should I have a bank account just because you do? Should I be compelled to follow after you because you are part of the majority? Should I be compelled to join Roman Catholicism because Roman Catholicism is by far and away the majority religion? No? If you were a Catholic, they'd say, well, yeah, of course. Now, if you're something else, you know, and the Jews, you know, they're just a tiny minority. If you take a look at their position, you know, shouldn't all Jews be compelled to join Roman Catholicism because it's the majority religion? Shouldn't all Baptists, Mormons, and everybody else be compelled to join? I mean, after all, what's all this holdout stuff? You know, what's this antisocial behavior on the part of you Jews and Protestants, huh? I mean, we got the same thing here. Why shouldn't you be compelled to join Social Security? Everybody else does. Well, not everybody else does. Not everybody else wants to. And in fact, I'll just bet you that if you left it up to people to choose in the marketplace, do I want to join Social Security? I'll bet you couldn't get 50%. So don't leave it up to you. But it isn't government that's compelling you to join Social Security. It's your employer. He just says, well, I can't hire you without a Social Security number, and that's exactly right. So if you want a job, you got to join Social Security. But you don't have to join Social Security. No law requires that. So I just opted out of the job market. I'm not looking for a job. All right, so they got down here to Five Guys, the last Five Guys. So they called the Five Guys in, and they said, okay, we're going to fire you. Next Friday's your last day, unless you join up. Four of the five signed up right on the spot. When it got down to Friday is your last day, they signed. Mark Vesey didn't. And guess what? He came back in the following Monday, and they didn't tell him to clean out his drawer. In fact, they didn't say a word to him. And then the following Friday, they paid him with a check. Now, he was the only man left at Texas Instruments getting paid with a check. And a couple of weeks went by, and he called me here at the school, and he said, they didn't fire me. I said, that was my take on it. I didn't think they would. I figured that when push came to shove, when it got right down to the wire. You see, threatening to fire him is not a damage. It's when you actually fire him. Here's a little point. One time I had a student who was a religious guy. He was working for the phone company. He'd been there for many, many years. And they have rotating shifts, and you have to work on Saturdays. Well, this guy decided that he wanted to start practicing the Sabbath on Saturday. So he went into his boss. And this is before he came to school here. I just want to point out there. He went into his boss, and he said to his boss, I want to keep the Sabbath. And he said, well, you can do that, but you got to work on Saturday when we need you. And he said, well, I can't work on Saturdays at all, period, from now on, forever, never, never, never. And they said, well, then you'll have to quit. And he didn't know what else to do, so he wanted to obey Jesus, and so he quit. Oh, they got him. See, if you can be cunningly coerced into waiving your rights due to your ignorance, they win, you lose. Can they do that? You bet. Do they do that every day? So by telling him that he'd have to quit, not knowing any better, he went ahead and quit. Now, when he came to school, I said, well, that was your mistake. See, if you hadn't quit, then they'd have to terminate you, and if they terminated you, that'd be an unfair labor practice. Can't do that. And they wouldn't have. They would have accommodated his religion. There's some rules that go along with it, but as a general rule, that's a slam dunk. Now, going back here to Texas Instruments, we decided to jack up the heat a little bit on them. I said, you know, you don't even have to take that check, so why don't we do it this way? If you want to put some heat under the fire here, want to put these guys' feet to the fire, you take your paycheck next week and you put on the back of it, cashed at law without recourse, then endorse it, and then take it down to their bank. Present it for payment and see what happens. Well, and that's called a restricted endorsement, and a bank won't take a restricted endorsement, and so the bank refused to cash the check. And what that means is the check is no good. That's what it boils down to. Cashed at law without recourse says, I'm not going to guarantee Texas Instruments credit. You see, your endorsement on the back of the check guarantees their credit. You worked for them for 40 hours. You deposit their check in your bank account. If the check bounces, where does the bank go to collect the money? They take it out of your account. And that's because you endorsed the check. Now, if you endorse the check and you say, without recourse, then the bank has no recourse against you. They only have recourse against the maker of the check. Well, they can't collect from the maker of the check if it's a bad check. Now, here's Texas Instruments. They take advantage of you in two ways. Number one, they take your labor from you, and they give you nothing for it. And then they give you a credit disbursement that you have to guarantee. Well, of course, as long as their credit's good, it's all right. What you're entering into now with this new Great Depression over here is that everybody's credit's failing. They like that. And so now the guarantor of last resort is the taxpayer. Guarantor of last resort is the employee. So the bank refused payment, and so he took it back to the company controller and said, your check bounced. Pay me, or I'm going to sue you to collect. So the controller looked at the check and said, well, it's because you put a restricted endorsement on it. He said, I'm not going to guarantee your credit. Pay me in $20 bills. Then you know what? Texas Instruments paid Mark Vesey in $20 bills. Well, for the next 3 months, they wouldn't fire him over the check, and now he's got him on a Panem cash, and they won't fire him over the cash. They don't like him. They'd like to get rid of him, and they did. He finally quit because he wanted to go into business for himself. But the question, remember, was, can they do that? And the answer is, well, they can do it to 69,999 Texas employees or Texas Instruments employees, but they couldn't do it to one guy simply because he wouldn't let them do that to him. All right, so now there's a little story for you. Now, while we're at it and we finished that one, why don't we just take a look here and tell you that you're listening to the Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective, not state schools and all. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. Now, the Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives, all of which can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the Law School and asking for it. The number is 417-273-4967. Once again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. And we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that the authors or publications that we endorse will necessarily reciprocate. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour and Editorial Review may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine. They're mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the views, the beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. So if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, then please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, let's take another little foray here into the realm of can they do that by looking at the Fairbanks Light and Power Company in Fairbanks, Alaska. Some years back, I was in Fairbanks, Alaska doing a school, and a young man came up to me and told me a story about how electric power is delivered here in Fairbanks, Alaska, which seemed to be at odds with the story that I had told everybody. I said, you know, there's limits here to what these public utilities and government agents and agencies can do. And he said, well, listen to this. I want to have the light company or the power company hook up power to my apartment. And when I do that, I have to go in and fill out a lengthy application. And I have to give them all of my information and my financial history. And I got to give them my social security number and driver's license number and all of these thingies that go into this application. And if I don't do that, they won't turn on my power. And he said, there's one more kicker. He said, you have to buy 5 shares of Light and Power Company stock. And if you don't buy the 5 shares, they will not turn on your power. So I said to the young man, now, sir, I'm sure that you believe every word that you've just told me. And I'm sure that the Light and Power Company has policies in place that require all of those things. But, sir, you have been deceived, and that's not the state of the law in Alaska. And I said, I'm not even an Alaskan, and I have never opened your Alaska statutes. And I can tell you that that policy is unconstitutional. It's illegal. It's unlawful. You cannot do that. And several other people in the audience pointed out that they do that, and they have done that, and they are doing that, and they won't turn on your power. Okay, well, I don't doubt that. For 128 years, I believe it was 128 years, it was from 1828 to about 1959. So let's see, 28, 38, 48, 58. Yeah, 128 years. The state of Alabama had a statute on the books that said black people have to ride the back of the public conveyances. And I think if you'd have walked into some audience in 1942 and said, that's not the state of the law in Alabama, it's unconstitutional, you can't do that. Everybody would have said, well, that's what they're doing, and they've been doing that for over 100 years. Now, who do you think you are? And I could say, I have never opened an Alabama statute book. I don't know what the statute is. I'm just telling you it's unconstitutional, it's illegal, it's unlawful, you can't do that. Now, when I'm sitting here at my desk, I'm looking up here on the wall, and I see the U.S. Supreme Court reports. It's a big, big set of books. It costs $8,000 when you buy them one book at a time. And they're literally, I'm looking at volume number 105A. It's the last volume I have in my set, which is back about 1988, I believe. Now, everything today is on disk, and so, you know, these books are kind of archaic. But my point is that all of these books contain thousands and thousands of cases that have been litigated based upon laws. Now, all of you understand, do you not, that you can't make black people ride the back of the bus anymore. See, now, that was an issue that was settled by an appellate court, and then the appellate court took a look at the policy, and they said, hey, no, that's illegal, you can't do that. But for 128 years, they had done it, and it was just as illegal in 1877 as it was in 1959. It was just as illegal in 1942 as it was in 1959. I mean, the year that this law struck down, you know, this isn't the year that the law changed. That law was always illegal. Now, the fact that people comply with an illegal law or an unlawful process is nothing against the state. For instance, I mentioned this the other day. Let me mention it again. 1964, the U.S. Supreme Court said the vagrancy laws in the United States are unconstitutional. You can't punish people because they're poor. You can't lock people up in jail because they don't have a certain amount of money. You know, they used to say when I was a kid, vagrancy was the cure-all charge for the policeman. If they couldn't find anything else, they would charge you with vagrancy. Now, I don't remember what the number was, but I think it was $5. If you didn't have $5 in your pocket at all times, don't you leave home without $5, you could be charged with vagrancy. And I don't know how long vagrancy laws have been around, but, you know, as far as I know, I was raised with it, and so I can remember reading the papers and listening to the news. And in Eureka, California, there would always be a number of people who had been charged with vagrancy and sentenced to jail. It was a jailable offense to be poor. I mean, if you didn't have $5, they'd just figure, well, you're some old wino, you're some drunk, you're some lazy guy, and you're not working, you don't have any money. Now, in 1964, the Supreme Court comes along and they said, hey, you can't do that. It's against the law. Now, how many people last year were convicted in the United States of America for vagrancy? The answer is 264,000. Now, those 264,000 people walked into court and they did not object timely or they pled guilty to vagrancy. Many states don't even have it on their books anymore, but the ones that do, there are a lot of laws that aren't enforced in a lot of places, you know, like adultery laws and things like that. But these are laws that are actually enforced and people are punished. And the law is unconstitutional. So I just want to let you know that things like that happen. Now, in this case, talking about the Fairbanks Light and Power Company, I invited the young man. I said, now, are you trying to get power at your apartment? And he said, yeah, I just moved, and I need to get power turned on. And I said, well, would you like to try a little experiment? I will go down to the power company with you, and I'll go in as a witness, and I'll just sit on the sidelines. Now, if you'll follow instructions, I'll tell you what you need to ask, and I'll show you how to fill out the form. And we will comply with all of their rules and regulations and laws. And I will predict that if you will follow this through, I don't know how long it's going to take you, son. It may be a month or 6 months, or it may be 2 or 3 years. But the power company will turn your power on. What we don't know is when. That's the bottom line. Will they turn it on before or after the Supreme Court orders them to? But what they're doing is illegal, and they can't do that. Now, most people, see, they don't want to wait 3 years. They want their power on right now. And they're not really serious about their rights. I mean, they will complain about, can they do that? Well, of course they can do that. They're doing it. Can they make black people ride the back of the bus? Of course, for 128 years, until somebody said, no, it's enough. I'm not going to do that anymore. Until somebody says, hey, this vagrancy crap over here is just that. Let's stop pleading guilty to vagrancy. Let's get a policy decision. Now, appellate courts do not just look at the evils going on in society and then say, gee, that's not good. Let's change that. They only get involved when you come to them, and you have to come to them in a very special way. I mean, you actually have to have a vital controversy at issue. And it comes from a case called Ashwander versus Tennessee Valley Authority, Ashwander versus TVA. There's 7 rules that you have to follow. And if you follow 6 of the 7 rules, you lose. If you follow 1, 2, 3, or 4 rules, you lose. If you can follow all 7 rules, you can get docketed. Now, just because you get docketed doesn't mean you're going to win your case. But the first olive out of the jar is you've got to get docketed in the appeals court to start with. And they set up a lot of roadblocks so that you can't get docketed, so that you can't get your case set for hearing, so that you can't get heard. I don't know if that's good or bad or right or wrong. I'm just a reporter. I'm just telling you the way the game's played, so you got to play it. And then once you get your case docketed, once you get your case heard, then the court will listen to it and they'll say, well, now, is this sound public policy? And in the case of religious free exercise, we have to offer them a least restrictive means. In other words, we've got to follow the least restrictive means test. And if the state isn't following that, then the court will follow our recommendation or something close to it. So the first thing we need to do is to set up, this is called the sting, and we have to have a goat. And so the young man is going to act as the goat, and we're going to go down, and we're going to see if the power company will violate his rights. We have to find out, will the power company refuse to turn on the power and violate the law? And then we need to be able to document this violation of the law. We've got to have witnesses, evidence, and testimony. We have to be able to identify the names, dates, times, places, facts, witnesses, and evidence that we're going to present that this company has an unconstitutional policy, either on its face or as it affects a suspect classification of persons. And then we need to take that into trial and then move it from the trial to the appellate court, to the state Supreme Court, and then to the U.S. Supreme Court. You know, if we need to. Oftentimes, you don't have to go all the way to Washington. I mean, you know, you can. Sometimes you can settle it right in the office. And like we mentioned the other day, we're talking about Irwin Hill with the Holiday Inn. Can the Holiday Inn require that you have a driver's license to rent you a room? And the answer is absolutely not. There are people in this country that do not have driver's licenses, and you can't set up an arbitrary standard and say, if you don't drive, then you can't rent a room at the Holiday Inn. That's preposterous poppycock. Does Holiday Inn do that? I don't know if they do it anymore, but they used to. And, of course, most people have a driver's license. To all the people with driver's licenses, they don't care. But what do you do if you're an Amish guy and you drive a buggy and you don't have a driver's license and you want to stay at the Holiday Inn? Sorry, dummy. Change your religion. Get a driver's license like everybody else. Or you can't get a room at the Holiday Inn. Well, does the Holiday Inn do that? Every day. Can they enforce that kind of policy upon Amish people? Not on your life if the Amish guy objects timely. All right, now let's go back here and let's take a look at this. So we go into the power company and just walk up to the counter and say, hey, my name is Joe Finkelstein. I'd like to get power. They'll hand you a form. Fill it out and answer every question. Where it says name, ask yourself the Denny's waitress test, do they need my name? I would say, yeah, probably. I mean, you know, they ought to know that your name is Joe Finkelstein, at least. What's your address? Well, if you get uppity and you don't give them your address, how can they turn on the power to a place that they don't even know where you live? So the power company needs to know what the address is, don't they? And in addition to that, don't they have to send you a bill every month? Don't you think they have to have your address to send you a bill and to send somebody out to turn your power on? So there's certain questions on this form that is necessary and imperative. You know, the doctor says, where does it hurt? I ain't going to tell you. I'm exercising my Fourth Amendment. Well, how in the hell is a doctor going to do anything for you if you don't tell him where it hurts? It's true the doctor doesn't need your Social Security number to fix what hurts, but he does have to know where it hurts. So let's be intelligent, shall we? And let's put down the necessary information that the power company needs. They need your name and address. Do they need your telephone number? I don't think so. Let's try this one out for a second. Let's suppose that you don't have a telephone. Does the power company then say, what's your telephone number? And you say, I don't have one. Oh, well, if you don't have a telephone number, we're not going to sell you power. No, if you went into a restaurant and they said, what's your telephone number? And you said, I don't have one. They said, well, we're not going to sell you lunch. A telephone is not a requirement to buy electricity from the power company. And neither is your Social Security number or your marital status or your sexual orientation. What if they ask you, are you gay or straight? Excuse me, if I'm gay, will you sell me power? But if I'm straight, you won't? Or if I'm vice versa? I mean, it's irrelevant. All right, so let's get back here to reality. We filled out every line on the application where it said Social Security number. We put in there Fourth Amendment objection. Boys and girls, you ought not to be giving your Social Security number out to just everybody. They might steal your identification and then go out and run up a lot of bills on your credit card, you know. Start thinking here. Got through with it, and the girl said, that's not satisfactory. You don't have certain information on here. And so at my prompting, he said, how much is the deposit? And she said, it's $150. But if you fill this out, here's the key. If you fill this out correctly, you don't have to pay the $150 deposit. Ah, this is a credit application. Nothing more, nothing less. Do you want credit at the power company? If the answer is yes, fill it out and answer all the questions. If the answer is no, fill out what they have to know to deliver power. Then protect your privacy by paying cash. And that's what a deposit is. When you put the $350 bills on the counter, in those days it was $150, you put the $350s on the counter, then we're paying cash in advance. And when I use up the $150, the power just shuts off. And they'll say, well, we can't do that. Well, they can today. In those days they couldn't, but today they can, right here where I'm at. And out here in the sticks, for crying out loud, they can turn your power off right in the office. I don't know how that works, but they can do that. All right, now, with that in mind, the girl finally said, well, I'll go get the manager. Because I said to her, she said, no, we can't turn your power on until this is filled out. I said, young lady, what's your name? And then she told me her name, and I wrote it down. And I said, how long have you worked here? And she said, I worked here 8 months. And I put 8 months down. And I said, now, did you spell your name J-O-N-E-S or S-M-I-T-H? I forgot what her name was. And she got a little bit nervous, and she said, who are you? And I said, well, I am a civil rights investigator, and I think you're in the process of committing a civil rights violation, and I'm documenting this for trial. Well, that just freaked her out. the thought that she was going to be brought into court to testify or possibly be named as a party to an action. She went back and got the manager. Manager came out. Or some manager. I don't know who this guy was, but he came out and and he was a little on guard now because she told him, you know, hey, there's something wrong here. The police are there. And undercover agents out there. And I'm not really an undercover agent. I was right out in the open. I wasn't under any cover. No, I'm just old George the plumber, and I'm just standing right here getting information, writing it down. I asked him what his name was. He went down. And I said, I can sue you as John Doe. I don't need your name. But it would be handy if we could do this man-to-man. You know, I can find out your name on discovery. I mean, if we need to go that far, I mean, we'll find out. So he went in and told me his name. And I said, okay. And then we went over this, and I explained to him. I said, now, this is a civil rights test. We think that your policy here violates certain principles of privacy, of constitutional due process, equal protection of the law, that it's a system that is designed to cunningly coerce people into waiving their rights due to their ignorance, and we don't want to do that. And so he said, well, you'll have to pay the deposit. I said, we never objected to it. There's the money. Take the deposit. And he looked at the form, and he said, well, you have to pay us, and I think the number was $25, $5 a share for 5 shares of stock. And I said, no, we're not going to do that. We do not want to buy. We do not want to participate in trade, commerce, business, or industry that affects any public interest. And he said, well, it's our company policy. And I said, I'm sure it is. But we don't want to participate in your company policy either. So not only aren't we going to fill out the credit application, we're not going to buy the 5 shares of stock in the co-op. Well, he didn't know what to do, so he left. And, well, he said, wait a minute. He left. He came back about 15 minutes later, and he said, okay, we're going to go ahead and turn on your power without the 5 shares of stock. And I can tell you what he did. He didn't tell me, but I can tell you. He went back, and he called their legal department. And he said, I got a couple of kooks out here. And here's what they're doing, and here's what they're asking, and here's what they're telling me. And they say they're not going to buy these 5 shares of stock. They say that they're not going to fill out the credit application. They've put the money for the deposit on the counter, and they're demanding to be hooked up. And the legal department said, you better hook them up. Well, it's either that or litigation. Now, if we went to litigation, would we win? We don't know. We never went to litigation. How do we know if we're going to win or lose? How do you know that the law in Alabama that requires blacks to ride the back of the bus is illegal or not if you never test it? Think about it. What if the bus driver had said, okay, lady, go ahead, ride the front of the bus. Go ahead, be an iconoclast if you want to. Go ahead, step out of line. See if I care. And they hadn't arrested her or caused her any damage. She might be the only black in Alabama to this day riding the front of the bus. We don't know. But you've got to be damaged in order to have an action. You don't have any standing in court if you walk in there asking for an advisory opinion. Is this law illegal or not? There is a modality called a declaratory judgment that can help you a little there. But as a general rule, damage is what's required. All right, now, will the power company back down? Well, in that case, they backed down. And why? Well, you know, when they're faced with what they believe is a credible lawsuit, or the potential of it, I've never seen them stand up to it. Because everybody in the know, hell, if you were a sophomore in law school, you'd know you can't do that. I mean, you don't have to be a lawyer. If you were a law school student, you know, there comes a point in time in your studies that you're going to find out, wow, why there's a lot going on out there that's illegal. Oh, yeah, congratulations, Tommy. Yeah, welcome to reality. There's a whole bunch going on out there that's illegal. But do they get away with it? Yeah, because, see, the average Joe Sixpack, he doesn't know what to do about it. He hasn't got a clue. That's why I keep telling you people, you need a modicum of law school training, so that you'll at least know where the lines are drawn in the sand, so that you'll at least know where to go look it up. You know, if you just had enough education to do some legal research, you know, one of the most valuable things that you can learn is legal research. Where do I find that in the law? You know, you can look most of this up online. Most of you people listening to me right now have a computer. And I don't. I can't even turn one on. I'm still using 3x5 cards, and I have to go look it up in a physical book. That's how dumb I am. Now, surely you people out there, you know, that can use a computer. If you could understand how to do legal research and do it on your computer, you know, you could find out what the state of the law is and what the appellate courts have said. You know, next time a cop gives you a ticket, you know, or he arrests you for vagrancy, don't you think you could remember to say, sir, this vagrancy statute was struck down as unconstitutional in 1964. Did you know that? Are you sure you want to arrest me and jail me? Don't you think that might be false arrest and false imprisonment? Don't you think maybe there might be some monetary consequences if you do this to me? Sir, don't you think maybe you should get a supervisor and talk to your legal department first? And I'm no guarantee that they're going to do that, but, you know, I was in jail one day, and the guy wouldn't take my fingerprints, you know. They like to do that because when they send your fingerprints in, they get paid in the old days $14 up in Boise, Idaho, from NCIC. The FBI pays them $14. So if they arrest you, you know, for urinating in public, they'll fingerprint you and book you because they want the $14. And I said, wait a minute, this violates Brown. No, not Brown. It was Davis versus Mississippi. And I said, you need a court order before you take my fingerprints here, son. And they got a little uppity. You know, Larry Richards came out. He was the sheriff's administrative assistant. And he said, don't make any marks on him. When we got through with that case over there, they paid me some damages. You know, you don't have to give them your fingerprints without a court order. Those fingerprints are incriminating. Those fingerprints are testimony. And here in Missouri, you got to get a court order under Rule 30B2. I mean, we got a rule out of our Supreme Court that says, hey, sheriff, here's the way you have to handle this. Here's what the law is. And you know, if you can tell the sheriff, you know, or the deputy, or the officer, hey, excuse me, sir, but did you know about Rule 30B2? Yeah, I think you should get a court order. I think you should call the judge and come in there with some probable cause. I think you should get a search warrant before you do that. Now, that's what legal research, and that's what knowing where the lines are drawing in the sand is important, or why it's important to you, so that the question of can they do that when it comes up, no, they can't. Now, in some cases, the answer is yes, they can. And you know where the policeman can do that, you ought not to be giving him a lot of flack now, because he's liable to use what's known as the minimum force rule on you. Minimum force. That means I'm going to make you do that by force, and if I have to kill you in the process, I will do so using the minimum force necessary. But if I have to kill you in the process, well, then that breaks the game. So before we get down to the minimum force rule over here, boys and girls, we should remember we need to know where the lines are drawn in the sand before we take on that project. Can they do that? Well, not at Fairbanks Light and Power. We tested that. Not at Texas Instruments, and we tested that. Hey, I'm out of time here again, kids. We're going to have to leave it right there and remind you that you've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review. Remember, we're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the law school and The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives, and all of it can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Hey, time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.